This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I want to speak mainly about the Erasure Trilogy, but before I do, I just want to read a little poem that seemed, while I was cobbling together the lecture, it seemed to me in a way to encapsulate all of my work to date since I started making images. It's a piece by Mahmoud Darwish entitled I Come From There. I come from there and I have memories. Born as mortals are, I have a mother and a house with many windows. I have brothers, friends, and a prison cell with a cold window. Mine is the wave snatched by seagulls. I have my own view and an extra blade of grass. Mine is the moon at the far edge of the words and the bounty of birds and the immortal olive tree. I walk this land before the swords turned its living body into a laden table. I come from there. I render the sky unto her mother, and I weep to make myself known to a returning cloud. I learnt all of the words worthy of the court of blood, so that I could break the rule. I learnt all the words and broke them up to make a single word, homeland. And in a way, I think I'd just like to offer you before I start a small group of images that I always like to return to because they provide a kind of, not only a kind of rooting for me, but I think a kind of means by which to encounter this other newer work in Israel and Palestine. And there's sort of four facets that seem to recur and are woven through my work over the last couple of decades. And they're very simple notions, but as someone born here in the States, raised in New York to mixed parentage, much of my early life was spent traveling between two cultures, two communities, different linguistic, across linguistic barriers. And I realized while I was in school here that much of my inquiry just in life was about trying to reconcile these two halves of myself. It's in Kenya they call you 0.5. You must be 0.5, half from here, half from there. So the earliest images I made actually were very simple. I think I didn't even understand them as having any merit if it weren't for my dear friend and teacher, Emmett Gowan. I was working more in a conceptual zone or aspiring to do that, and then I slowly started to realize, though these things came naturally to me, that perhaps it wasn't wrong if something comes naturally to you, if it's just an extension of your emotion and your psyche. It's an image here from Lamu, where I have part of my family. I would travel each summer. It's Siddiqui's niece, Khala, 1 year old. All of these images, by the way, are just from the time I was about your age finishing college. My first project, actually, of a longer duration was after I hitchhiked across Africa. I wanted to have a sense of Kenya within the broader scope of the continent. And I also wanted to go to South Africa at a time in 89 when people were agitating for divestment, boycotting in a similar fashion to the way in which they do with Israel today. And I remember even at that moment understanding that if you intend to put your questioning and intellect to exploring the substance of what you're going to find, that certainly that has greater value than out-of-hand dismissing. It's an image from the Boselli School for the Blind. I spent several months living in the Laboa homeland in the north of the country. And then early in the 90s, Kenya experienced the influx of 500,000 refugees from Sudan, Ethiopia, and Somalia. And this, in a way, this image is perhaps the most instructive for me in all the time I've been working, in that I didn't know what it meant to work in such a heady political atmosphere. I had no intention of being a photojournalist. I didn't really know what that meant. But I did know when I went back to Kenya, I had a Fulbright that year, that it was important to find a way, perhaps, to address the most salient issues for the country at the time. So I got permission from the UN to travel to the Sudanese border, and it was a border that had 50,000 refugees at the time, incidentally, most of whom are still there today. And I remember this as an area that I, growing up, had visited many times when it was just a desert. And here, landing at the landing strip after the spokesman had told us what we would encounter, were droves of people inhabiting the desert. I didn't really know. I was so kind of intimidated. I had no idea how to work in such a place, under such pressure. And in a way, with such teeming emotion. And staying behind, I think, deciding not to just turn and come back home with the rest of the journalists and writers, I slowly realized that perhaps a mode for me could be just as simple as to ask the community themselves what they think is the most important thing, rather than imposing oneself on a community, perhaps remain open to listen to what they have to instruct, what they have to tell about their history, their circumstance. And it was also the moment that Somalia was being rendered in a way that always gave you this sense, like here in the New York Times, of people who were victims of this cruel world. You never had the notion that it was a community, perhaps, that was going through hardship, but yet at the same time might be able to bolster one another. And this is an image of Akwat Nyebul, who's the pregnant woman at center, with her sister Riak Warabek and her daughter Athok Doom, who's recovering from malaria. And for me, I think only latterly did I realize the beauty of what they had done together. I quickly realized that anything that I would ask someone to do would pale in comparison to the thing that they would do of their own accord, the way in which they would offer their caring to this niece and this daughter, people who'd never been photographed before. That was the most important gesture for them. And that's something that I've taken with me throughout working in refugee camps, is this idea that it is about community, that we're visitors, but in a way the priority is to defer to them and to remain as attuned as you can to the cadence of what they have to tell. Similarly, that year on the Rwandan border, where there were 250,000 refugees flooding across in one single day. And what was astonishing for me somehow in this moment was the birthing midwife, Nira Bahiri Esteri, in the middle, is holding the two children that she has given birth, or she has helped birth, the night before. And the names of the children, Mukanza Bonimpa, God will give me, but I don't know when, and Dimwa Bahari, all were about a notion of promise despite what they were enduring. And I found that really extraordinary. The Somali border was much more volatile and obviously remains so to this day. The area in which I live, in Lamu on the northern border, it's about 40 kilometers from Somalia. And as you probably know, that area is now much more volatile than it ever was in the past. And I visited there in the early 90s. The refugees are still there to this day. And much of my work comes out often of an encounter, a simple conversation, or a kernel of some sort of comment that I want to try and test with the process of working. One evening I was in the UN compound, and a doctor came to me and told me of the incidents of Somali families smothering their children in this border crossing between Somalia and Kenya. And such an extraordinary claim, I asked him, why and how could that be possible? And he said, but it is common knowledge that Somalis are callous by nature. And it seemed to me, in this instant, you've written off a whole society. This is a similar way in which we're thinking about the refugee situation these days. So rapidly, a blanket condemnation of a whole community, a whole religion, a whole society. And so I spent 2 weeks in one of the feeding centers for the most malnourished children. These were centers that the families were bringing the children twice a day for feeding, 3 hours at a stretch. And during this time, the German ambassador had sent somebody to pick the most malnourished child. He arrived at the camp, they put the baby in his arms, they took the photograph, got back on the plane and left for Nairobi. And so you have the idea that so much is orchestrated with a kind of preconceived notion of what that world is, of what those people are like. And this continues to rankle me, actually. This is an image of Khadija and her father, Badal Adin Gadel. Khadija had been mute because in the flight from Somalia, she had been separated from her mother. And apparently that's a common trauma. And just one other little vignette, because my friend Eduardo is here and they just were speaking about that passage from Of Veils and Mourning. Much later, I worked in a small town called Vrindavan in northern India. It was the town to which, and still to this day, to which widows migrate when their husbands die. Often they're seen as having been responsible for having brought the ill luck. Their inauspiciousness renders them cast out from the family. And they go to this town, ironically enough, seeking the solace of Krishna, the very thing in a way that put them there, the very system that put them there, is the system to which they turn for solace in their last years of life. And as Eduardo always thoughtfully wrote, the entry to this piece, to this book, I mean, the book is really, the hope is that it's kind of cinematic or building one image onto the next. But it defies the opportunity for you to move directly into their stories. It rather insists that you scale yourself back and try to imagine perhaps what these women might see as they're experiencing the town in which they live. That was essential for me. The other thing that was essential for me was this notion that we as artists potentially could reach across various divides. I don't like the notion of being relegated to a gender, a religion, a nation. I rather loved the idea that perhaps it might be possible to make a piece about women that a viewer, if they didn't know you, might imagine could only be made by a woman. This idea somehow of trying to chip away at barriers, chip away at prejudice, use the medium, the process of working as a means by which to challenge preconceptions, hopefully, and perhaps also ask a viewer to engage a conversation in a more complex manner. So it's those sort of four little kernels or things that have really been infused throughout this work, the Erasure Trilogy. I was invited in 2010 to be part of a group of 12 artists who would spend 6 or 8 months in Israel in the West Bank. And it was an extraordinary kind of commission invitation, but one which gave me great trepidation in the sense that at once I was not sure that I could make something of value for what they were asking. And secondly, I didn't want to be instrumentalized. I didn't want to be hampered or limited in the kinds of things that I could look at, even though I didn't know what that might be. It was important to me where the funding came from, because I understood the notion of what the boycott meant. I understood the notion, as I still do, of the right to inquire and think freely about a place. But they were very open to me, and it was, in fact, two or three trips I think I made on my own without accepting, because I wasn't sure that I had found the thing that resonated with my other projects, the trajectory of my own work. But I started by interviewing combatants on either side of the divide, Israelis and Arabs. It seemed to me, if you were going to take a commission to go to this place, you could only do so if you were going to confront the most pressing issues of the time. And for me, 48 was the place to start. Amazingly, perhaps because of my mixed nature, or perhaps because I was an outsider, I have been given great hospitalities on both sides of the divide, something actually which either an Israeli or a Palestinian would not be, they would not be accorded that kind of license, that kind of permission. But I was sitting one afternoon speaking with an Israeli who grew up in the outskirts of Tel Aviv, and he was telling me how, when he was a child, he spoke Arabic because his neighbors in the area were Arabs, and how then he became a combatant, and what that kind of rift had meant not only for his life, but for his whole society. And this became very clearly the thing for me to want to engage, perhaps also because it seemed so obvious to me. It just seemed like the clearest starting point as a kind of primer to look at the trajectory from the beginning to today. And curiously, what surprised me and still does is that within the society, the permission to speak about that time is still very fraught. But I hoped, and I still hope, that a kind of invitation to think about what happened in a generous way is a starting point to a discussion to find a way forward. And so I started after that one meeting, when this gentleman told me about a battle in Latrun, I started searching for the areas that were the sites that had been the 400 or so villages that the Palestinians had been evacuated from. The notion was always that this was a land without a people for a people without a land, but of course this was not the case. There were 700,000 Palestinians living in the land at the time of the founding of the state. And so many of the places, this is an area called Deir Rafat, many of them had been rendered to the ground, so they were difficult to find. I used often old history books, word of mouth, some NGOs that still were documenting the spaces. And I just began traveling to them, visiting them, wanting in some way to respond to them, to honor them, to try and find out what was subsumed within the land. What had this trauma meant for the whole region that is so intractable that nobody seems to be able to make any headway? This is Salama in the outskirts of Tel Aviv. Sometimes what one would find was the inside of a shrine or a cemetery. These were often the things that weren't desecrated or destroyed. And in other instances, the places were completely razed to the ground. Even school children were brought to them to take the rubble away so that the whole history might be completely removed. What soon occurred to me was that this license that I had to move from one community to the other might enable me to be a kind of conduit. So I thought, in looking at these villages, I then wanted to try and trace the people who had once lived there 65 years ago at the time. They themselves had never returned to the village, but I could go across either into the refugee camps or into the West Bank, and I could find these people. Many were 80, 90, upwards of 100 years old. Anissa was 103 when I met her in the Arab town of Umm al-Fahim. And they would tell me with great precision about facets of their village, not only the life that they remember when they grew up there, but also what to look for when I would return, or what I should do for them, or what photograph I should make for them. And this was a very charged moment, this idea that you were seeing something that they so desperately for 65 years had wanted to see, and yet you could also offer them something by way of reporting back or sharing that notion of kind of a notion of catharsis, right? A notion that somebody's still listening to what you have to say and values what you have to say. This is the inside of the shrine at Salama. Many of the spaces had been planted atop by the Jewish National Fund, so that today they're densely forested regions. This is Suba, which was a thriving village, but when one looks from the hill across the land, all you see are mature pine trees planted, evergreens planted, because they would grow rapidly, and they would also be able to squelch the plantation of the Palestinians with the darkness and the acidity of the pine needles squelching the fruit trees. So this was also a kind of sleuthing, trying to find out little clues within the land that might be harbingers of what had happened. Often you found nothing, but it was meditative in the sense of trying to connect, trying to unearth, trying to reimagine what the life had been there when it was infused with the refugees' being. For me, there was a kind of fluidity between the way in which you saw these spaces being slowly erased and the generations slowly dying off. I think three of the six portraits of people that are in the book that I produced last year or the year before have since passed away. So as these spaces are being subsumed within the land, the people, they themselves, are slowly passing away. And in essence, a moment of time that we now can approach will soon be gone entirely. This is Lifta, just on the outskirts of Jerusalem, one of the larger communities, still fairly much intact and sometimes inhabited by squatters. Apparently, when you visit the sites, you're supposed to smoke a little weed, but I didn't figure that part out. This is a place called Barka in the north. Kalunia. So the majority of the spaces are forbidden to the Palestinians. On occasion, if you are older than 35 and have children and in a house, you may have the opportunity to get a pass from time to time to come within the borders. But now, in the current situation, it's very difficult for people to cross the divide and to visit the places from which they were exiled. This is a place called al-Shuf. Excuse me. Three generations of the Mahmoud family. This is the cemetery at Ramla. And one of the stronger testimonies I heard was from this gentleman, Munir, who had been at Deir Yassin, which is a very famous site of massacre at the time of 48. And he offered me his testimony, which is part of actually the installation at Slot. But what was so extraordinary to me was that in all the years since he had fled, his family, two members of his family had been killed in front of him. In all the years since his flight, nobody had come to ask for his story, to record his story, to bring it forward. So he was essentially shunted from the land after losing two of his family members and lives in the tight confines of the Shufat refugee camp. This is about all that remains of the village from which he came, Deir Yassin. It's a shattered cemetery on the slopes of, actually it's an insane asylum, a mental asylum on the north side of a settlement. Kalunia. Many of these spaces that are still existing or have the or within the forests, or in the corridor between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, which was a prized route of access that was part of much of the war, Al-Tira. And of course, that impacted both Muslims and Christians alike, Palestinians. Ahmad Fuad, this is also, you would visit people, they would show you images from the time when they were married or when they were living in the village, and then you sit with them that day and they recall those years ago. Zoraya Hanafi. In Jarash, the area where people hid in the caves after the village was attacked. And that book, that piece ends with some images from areas that were depopulated in the after the war of 67. As I mentioned, many of the sites became national parks, were forested, so that when you go today, this is Al-Qabu, it's extremely difficult to find any trace of what was there before. And in a way, this offers a kind of a segue to the second body of work within this trilogy. It's entitled Desert Bloom. Desert Bloom, from the invocation of Ben-Gurion and before, to make the Negev flourish through industry and the hard work of the arriving Jewish community. I was invited one day down to the south to an area called Al-Araqib and to meet the headman of the village there, Sheikh Sayach. And what you see here is the perimeter of the cemetery, and the cemetery encircled partially by trees within that perimeter. And what's difficult to see in the upper portion are a set of blue kind of lean-to tents. And what had happened was, several weeks prior to my visit, the village had been surrounding the cemetery there. And the IDF had come, the Israeli Defense Force, and had razed the entire village, turning it to rubble. And so, sitting with this elder underneath one of these tents, looking out across this expanse of land, and he's telling me about what was there only weeks before, now what's on the land, or this scarification that you see, is actually the architecture of what will be the coming forest. So each one of those incisions in the land is in fact a trough for four or five seedlings. So the notion then that the same process that was undertaken in 48-67 of afforestation, of transforming the land, in this case even bulldozing it in a way that the contours of the land can be completely manipulated and transformed into something that will be more European in nature in the future, was absolutely shocking to me. And when you're on the ground, you can't really understand the magnitude of what that means. And I'd never worked from the air, but it became immediately apparent to me that it was important to see this space within a broader context, to know what Al-Araqib was like, not only what Al-Araqib was like, but what this notion, this invocation to make the desert bloom, what that has done, how that has transformed the desert in the years since the founding of the state. And so I got permission to fly up with a small plane with the door off. Here, the first notion you have to have is always you have to have a selfie, so there's a self-portrait in the middle. But it's right on the outskirts of Al-Araqib is what was the munitions storage during the British military occupation there. And so you have at once radical transformation of the space. In this case, is the edge of Al-Araqib on an area called the Ambassador Forest, wherein they brought ambassadors from all over the world to come and plant seedlings in what will be a forest on what is the remains of Al-Araqib. And yet most of these ambassadors knew nothing about the rift or the argument over the land between the local Bedouin community and the state. It was only the South African ambassador, in fact, who refused the offer to plant trees, saying that he himself had lived through apartheid at home and didn't intend to mete that out in foreign land. So this again is an extension of by the JNF of the ambassador forest. But in fact, what had happened was often areas that had been Bedouin, the proper means by which to acquire the land in a smooth fashion would be to say that it was being taken to be a nature reserve by the JNF, and then perhaps after a time for it to be developed in another mode as either a settlement. In this case, it will become the railroad line to Ashkelon. So what I started to do as I was flying above the land, not really understanding what it was I was looking at, you can't imagine what these things are on first glance. I started then laterally to take the coordinates and to then explore, even on a simple Google Earth platform, what had happened, what had transpired in that spot over the last decade. So in this case, in the Ambassador Forest, what one sees around the time that I made the photograph, this is just prior to my photograph, and then the sweep goes all the way to 2013 through the time I'd photographed, and this area that was at the center part of the forest now becomes the central access to the railroad line to Ashkelon. And this is then somehow that became a kind of obsession of mine, was to go fly above the desert to respond to what it had to offer, often not even knowing what kinds of clues I was gathering, and then to go back and to research both with Google Earth and with other experts of aerial surveillance what the little clues signified. So in this case, we have three circles, but in fact, they're corrals of the sheep from the Bedouin community that had been there. And the corrals themselves are burned every year. So one realizes that the most recent habitation is in the upper right hand. The second one is from the year prior, and the third one 2 years before. And there's a halo of one next to that. So that, in a way, gives you a hint that there was and is a community moving on a regular basis through this spot on Earth. This is quite close to Al-Araqib. Again, then sometimes you would see vestiges of the past. The little two little rectangles in the lower right-hand quadrant of the image was a small house near where a massacre had taken place, and it was razed to the ground. These little echoes are of the shelving there is what would normally surround the Bedouin shacks to protect them from sand and the rain. And in this case, one can hardly tell, but the image of the other, the areas on the bottom of the image have been prior Bedouin settlements. But in fact, the IDF has used the upper quadrant, the top three, to make areas for military maneuvers, which are then hidden within the sense of it being a former Bedouin village. Now it's a closed military firing zone. Also military structures that are meant to mimic the kinds of edifices or the kinds of fortifications they would encounter in Egypt or in Syria or Lebanon. Here you see a village still, an unrecognized village still existing, where you see also the corrals at the center and several years of having burned and faded. Military call them pitas. All the military maneuvers along the southern border, that was basically the time that we could fly, was during Shabbat and the early morning of the next day. And as we would come back in this small Cessna, that was when the military craft were coming over for their maneuvers on the southern border with Egypt. And this is all fairly close to the Egyptian border, the area of an extension of Arad. And then there are those things which one can't see from the ground. These kinds of wrinkles that one sees are in fact the remnants of a Nabataean village. You can see at the far left the path actually that went to the center square. This is something from the ground. You have no sense of what it is, but from aloft you have a sense of the contours. Former Bedouin shack in an unrecognized village. But it wasn't only the recent transformations. There are still vestiges, as I said, of the historical impact on the land, of the Nabataeans. This is an area that actually was to mimic the Nabataean means of irrigation. The sharp trough at the center was to bring the water into these little channels, these little rectangles, that then would be used during part of the year for planting. Again, to keep the perimeter of the garden walls high so that the moments that they have the limited rainfall, they can sustain something. There at the bottom, you also see what was a former Byzantine structure. Here again, movement areas for herds along the top ridge, but the lower conical forms are actually directing the water into the troughs at the base of the base of the hill. For seismic tests. Much of the southern part of the country is trimmed with graph-like incisions. The motion was that they were trying to find oil at a certain time in the 80s, and though they never found it, when one flies aloft, you can see stretching to the horizon these sort of deep incisions into the land. It also happens to be one of the main smugglers' routes along the Egyptian border, both smuggling drugs and smuggling people. It was the incense route. This area atop the hill there was the sentry post guarding people when they moved along the incense route. Military maneuvers along the border, one side and the other. The interesting thing to me was, while working there, that you imagine in one way two different orientations towards the land, two different senses of what it means to inhabit a space. Here with the Bedouin, you see that they somehow are able to eke out an existence in a very inhospitable climate, a very inhospitable terrain. They move on when it's necessary. They come back when the weather allows them to plant. And the bulwark of the state sees it differently, that the land in a way should conform to the wishes of those who inhabit it. And they have, the Israeli state or the Israeli organizations have made extraordinary advances, for instance, in irrigation. They make this netafim, which is this hose pipe that can be rendered along the ground in the desert area to make it arable. But then where is it? That what is the sign of what lay there before? You see, in a way, the kind of fragile balance of a life in that desert. That's a village that's still thriving. So it's also different notions of what is acceptable. The Israeli state would like to create these townships in which the Bedouin shall live. And the Bedouin themselves are used to the notion of moving, to having their herds, to being out with much land to surround their life. And so these two imperatives are completely incompatible. military encampment, and the start of what will be the largest military camp in Israel in the south that will house 20,000 soldiers. This is a mock landing strip. When I was working with an Israeli aerial expert, he had asked how you had gotten permission to go there. Much of the area in the south is closed off, obviously, for military maneuvers. And here is a mock strip, a fake strip, and the dummy bombs have been pockmarking the whole of the strip that one can see moving up to the upper edge of the image. The last of a village, and yet you can see that two structures have been re-erected and will be shortly demolished once again. Many of the chemical firms from the north of the country are moved to the south. A very short sense of returning to Al-Araqib, because it provides a kind of extraordinary and pointed notion of what is happening to these unrecognized villages. I worked with A.L. Weitzman on a follow-on book to Desert Bloom, in which we went back to Al-Araqib and investigated some of the things that people had documented themselves of the history, and then also using aerial images from the past, from RAF archives, British War Archives, means by which to, in a way, prove the notion that these people had been living on the land prior to the state, prior to the start of the state. This is the main elder of the camp, Sheikh Sayach, who still today, after 95 demolitions, this area here has been demolished more than 95 times now. The first time in 2010, they rebuilt immediately these protest tents and started inhabiting once again the inner area of the cemetery. Almost on a weekly basis, the IDF has come and razed the houses to the ground. And each time, the families build again and build again and build again, 95 times in succession to the moment now. And this is Nouri al-Oqbi, the man who has more than 50 court cases against him in the Israeli courts, and who has been fighting to keep the land that he and his family have on the outskirts of Al-Araqib. Much of that book is looking much more rigorously at the documentation these people had about their lives, the proof for their lives on the land, the way in which they had documents from the Ottoman era, even before the British Mandate era. Titles to land. In this case, on the bottom left, there's a voter ID that was given to the family in 1951. There's a color image of herbicides being flown over the seedlings of a new crop that's been planted by the Bedouin. So in a way, to squelch the community to the point wherein they move to the townships. We then found a 1945, as I said, RAF image that actually captured the area of Al-Araqib. And by blowing this image up, we were able to see elements of what we've already seen together. In the top left, you have the seer, the areas of the corrals. You have huts on the right. You have British fortifications in the middle, houses and dams, all evidence of the presence of the Bedouin from 1945. Here we have a well, as seen in the 1945 enlargement, and an image of that exact same space that I went to on the ground. This notion of kind of moving across divides, moving across history, moving across space, moving from up bird's eye military perspective to being part of what it is to be on the ground. This is the home, the remains of the home of Nouri al-Oqbi's father. Now you see, in the upper right hand, the light very blown out in this image, the upper right hand area is the perimeter of the cemetery that we've seen earlier. Within the cemetery, there are graves that are from before 1911. This one in particular. In the time since I made this photograph, the IDF has come. For many months, they refused to enter the perimeter of the cemetery. The state usually doesn't desecrate, as I said, the cemeteries. But as the community had moved within the cemetery to find seek refuge there, they have taken down the whole of the perimeter, and in another successive wave of razings, they've wiped out all of the houses that were there. So now the few villagers that remain, the few families that remain, sleep outside under the trees, refusing to leave. I'd just like to end with one piece that you don't even have to hear my voice for. I always hoped when I was working in Israel and Palestine that I would be able to be open to both communities, that I would be able to make something empathetic and heartening and connected to both sides. And when I first arrived there, I met with a wonderfully generous artist, very committed also politically, he himself, and he said, well, you have to take a side. And in the 5 years I've been there, I've really struggled with that. I understand the inclination, but I don't understand the sense of letting your work fall within a clear political mode without remaining receptive to what the other has to offer, without remaining open to conversation. And the sense of hospitality and warmth that I was blessed with in both communities is something that is very humbling. And I was, on a daily basis, I was humiliated. But I was moving from Israel to the West Bank almost on a daily basis. But I was also with families and individuals experiencing some of the most extraordinary warmth and generosity that I've had anywhere, in any place that I've worked prior. And I still don't know how quite to reconcile that. That, you know, you listen to somebody on one side who has such palpable hatred for the other person. And you go the next day and you meet somebody on the other side and they feel exactly the same way, but they've both offered you an embrace. And so in a way, going back to 48, trying to figure out how to articulate that expanse of time between 48 and today, I thought perhaps a mode might be through the portrait. A diptych, one pair for every year from 1948 to today. Well, at the time it's 3 years now, 2.5 years. 65 years, 1 year-olds, 2 year-olds. And so I just would like to share that with you quietly. And this notion that we've spoken before, my friend and I, about how you can only really attend to one of them at a time. How is that? How is it that one can feel empathy for one on one side one moment and another on the other side the next?